4:103. The other is not any one thing found in any particular place. It is a quality of, or rather visible in, all things, like a specific color. It shines through them at us. We see it, and it sees back, as in a dialogue. If it can be seen at all, it can be seen immediately, not merely in some exotic far-off setting. 1. The other exists. 2. We can experience it. 3. It is found everywhere. 4. Therefore, since it exists, since we can experience it, and since it can be found everywhere, we can encounter it here. The opportunity exists now. Lem is wrong in all respects. What is needed is a tremendous increase in our brain efficiency, a vital improvement in set group discrimination. Once we have done so and locked onto it, we can probably continue to hold it in view. We're talking here about a two-hemisphere perception of reality, and then an information transfer from one hemisphere to the other, so that cognition, not just perception, is brain total. Note: Dick often writes as if he assumes that the left and right hemispheres of the brain do not normally communicate with one another. Perhaps this misperception grew out of Roger Sperry's work on split brain perceptions in the late 1960s, one of a number of studies that inspired the popular discussion of the lateralization of brain function in books like Robert Ornstein's The Psychology of Consciousness, 1972, which Dick was familiar with. However, Sperry's work was done with patients in whom the corpus callosum, the bundle of fibers connecting the two hemispheres, had been surgically severed as a treatment for otherwise incurable epilepsy. In normal brains, there is continuous communication across the hemispheres. Dick's belief that it may be possible to boost brain efficiency, although not technically correct with respect to the right and left hemispheres, is right on the mark with regard to reparative plasticity, in which neural circuits are repurposed to make up for deficiencies in normal brain function caused by an injury or trauma. Reparative plasticity may have been precisely at issue in his own brain function, if indeed he did suffer from TIAs and had his own neural circuitry rearranged as a result. NKH. End note. The morphology is already in place. All encounters in the phenomenological world, in time and space, are exterior encounters with constructs of our own mind, here and anywhere else we go. To experience truly, genuinely to encounter any other living entity in itself, one would have to be in it and have it in one. This would be an interior experience. One would see nothing outside, no object, but suddenly one would experience all reality through the vision of the other, as if seeing out through its eyes. One would share and inhabit its world, possess its perspective. At the same time, the other would possess what one had as a worldview. This might be close to a sort of energy symbiosis, an exchange of plasmas. One would not see the other. One would see as the other. Not possess it, but possess its world. And this would not be so much as an I am in your world and you are in mine, but both would share a world made up from both previous separate worlds, a superimposition greater than either had possessed, a total sharing within, and a total shared view of what lies outside. This sudden double superimposed simultaneous view would be experienced as gaining an additional depth, as if adding one more spatial dimension, much as a flatlander acquiring three-dimensional space. Time, too, would be experienced differently. One could see ahead in all temporal directions. Two separate mono views, when blended, become a stereo view. Both entities, surprised by the heightened perception, would probably attribute it to the other's ability, not realizing he himself supplied half. What a marvelous entity has taken me over, each would think, astonished. Look at what he can see that I never could. Each would be awed by the other, i.e., the other. Plato once expressed an idea, probably metaphoric, that each of us is really only one half of a four-legged, four-armed organism. Somehow, long ago, we got split apart, and we're always searching for our missing other half. Note: the reference here is to Aristophanes' speech in Plato's Symposium, where the playwright explains the origin of love, Eros, with the myth that the first human beings were akin to conjoined twins of opposite sex, bound face to face, hands to hands, feet to feet, who became separated. The fire of desire flows from the attempt to retrieve our lost unity. Here as elsewhere, the exegesis can be seen as a long tug of war with Plato. There are constant references to Plato's theory of anamnesis, or recollection, which is the remembrance of the forms, the pure core of reality perceived within the soul through the activity of intellection, or nous, that were allegedly forgotten due to the painful trauma of our birth. Dick also refers to Plato's analogy of the cave from Republic, and to the true universe as idea or form, eidos, of which phenomenal reality is a mirror or scanner through which we see darkly. Later in the exegesis, Dick also finds reason to harshly reject Plato, who he will declare is 180 degrees wrong. SC. End note. This usually is construed as a man searching for his female mate. However, suppose the great builder has fashioned us humans here, each of us, as one half of a total organism, the other half of which is not a human being, but something totally different, maybe with no physical body at all, but a sort of energy plasma which fits over or is poured into each of us, as the Parakletos is said to be. This might indicate that our total life on Earth is only the first part, the part before each of us and his other are joined. Possibly many, if not most of us, die before being joined. Maybe we never are, or we are joined after death. Meanwhile, off somewhere in another star system, the great builder has fashioned the other parts of us, and soon we will be stimulated by him to take off into space and head via rocket ship for that star, not knowing what lies ahead, but prompted by a vast and authentic instinct that we should do it. Imagine our surprise, and then delight, when we get there and are suddenly joined in the twinkling of an eye with our other half, the other. On their own planet, the race of others might have even less total vision of their purpose in the universe than we have. However, it is possible that their guesses and intimations might be ahead of our own. In this case, they might be waiting for us to arrive, or even made certain attempts to contact us, with or without success. At the ultimate, they might even have managed in small preliminary ways to reach across space to us somehow to coax us subtly into moving toward them. A few of them, a small part of their total energy, might have arrived here already, even long ago, and touched a few of us, bringing those few into the total entity the builder was preparing. That entity would, in our words, be a man and also a spirit, touched by the Holy Spirit, or born a second time, whatever, born of water and spirit perhaps. And being all this, he would have a lot to tell us. We are going to link up. In all this, we would become aware of, one, those creatures toward which we moved with whom we were to link up, and, two, the great builder himself moving all things. Regarding the first, we would have a natural instinctive tendency to venerate them as godlike, but in fact, on their own, without us, they are probably no more and no less than we. It is the fusion which is superior. Their proper attitude toward us might well be the same veneration as ours toward them. What is truly to be venerated and revered is the builder himself and his plan, which caused both our species to come into being and then move toward each other to join. True worship should go to him alone. We would experience him as the powerful, gentle will within us, prompting us to move toward our other halves. They are, like us, created. He is self-creating always. It's interesting that Jesus spoke of being born again as being born of water and spirit, which is from two sources, two coming together, in contrast to being born from the womb, one source, one element. He was indicating a fusion. Water, perhaps, indicated on our own part, with the other, the Spirit, coming down from above. Certainly, Jesus was speaking about a totally different kind of birth, just in that respect alone. Two elements joined together and became one entity. Another difference between the first birth and the second is crucial. We do not decide to be born in the first place. It happens to us. But the second birth, born again, requires a decision. This means that it does not occur naturally or spontaneously, and in fact, may not occur at all. It must be accomplished, done by us, or anyhow sought for. Somehow the Spirit must be enticed or welcomed or attracted. Water, our part of the two agents necessary, we obtain in the sacrament of baptism. But we can't perform the other part, obtaining the Spirit. We must wait for it to arrive, having done our part, the water part. Evidently, for some reason the Spirit can't come to us unless the water, baptism, is there. Baptism must change us in a way we can't see, perhaps making us a conductor, grounded, and hence able to attract an electrical-like field from the heavens, sky. For all we know, the Spirit is up there perpetually, awaiting only the crucial change, water, below, to come down and enter. Like Beethoven, the Creator is a joiner, not of organizations, but of sections assembled separately in different places, and then somehow brought together. The places are our category, space then, when brought together, time. If the other is not bound by the categories of perception, time, and space, then he is here now, was here, will be, and, since not phenomenalistically, then he is not outside, but within us. Like Plotinus's concept of concentric rings of emanation, we encounter our others in gradually increasing intensity and clarity. They become clearer to us continually. It is as if the will which drives animals and bugs, in the form of blind instinct, begins one day in us to actually speak. This is the Logos, perhaps. Letter to Ursula Le Guin, September 23, 1974. Note. Ursula Le Guin, born 1929, is an SF and fantasy writer from Berkeley. Though she and Dick were nearly the same age and attended the same high school, the two never met, but they did correspond as friends and colleagues throughout the 1970s. In February 1981, Le Guin gave a lecture at Emory University attended by author and critic Michael Bishop. Le Guin made some disparaging comments about Dick's later work, specifically the treatment of women in Valis, 1981. Le Guin wondered aloud if Dick was slowly going crazy in Santa Ana, California. When Bishop passed Le Guin's remarks on to Dick in a letter, Dick responded publicly, writing an angry letter to Science Fiction Review. Le Guin apologized, but had clearly hit a nerve. Dick took Le Guin's criticisms seriously, and in many ways, Dick's final novel, The Transmigration of Timothy Archer, 1982, with its deep, intelligent, and charming female first-person narrator, Angel Archer, was written in response. D.G. End note. 4.106. Dear Ursula, I just sent you a big manila envelope of material, but I wanted to say this, that the 14-page piece is all true. It really did happen to me, and it is strange, and I can't fully explain it. Which is to say, name who what poured itself into me back in March and is still there, still here, I mean, still in a symbiotic relationship with me. Tom Dish came back a couple of weeks ago, and I told him about it. He suggested that perhaps it was Elijah who had possessed me, and so I read up on Elijah. That explanation fits as well as any other, and so I ran with that until last night, when, in falling asleep, I thought the words poros and crater, and then looked them up today, and sure enough, once more, they are Greek words, and words which I certainly didn't know. I doubt if Elijah would be ruminating in Greek, but he probably reappeared, after two parts of his spirit returned to Elisha, as John the Baptist, and then other Essenes. It is probably all one spirit which can divide itself in any fashion it wants, like the advocate which Christ says he will have God send after he, Christ, is gone. All these are one. This is a mystery, but to me very exciting. The spirit which filled me starting in March was primarily rooted in these realities: justice, truth, and freedom. His pursuit of the first and his devotion to the second is what made Tom Dish think of Elijah, I think. The spirit, when he arrived here, looked around, saw Richard Nixon and those creatures, and was so wrath-filled that he never stopped writing letters to Washington until Nixon was out. Note: since I last wrote you, the magnitude of the despotic gang of professional organized criminals who came to power legally, as did Hitler in Germany, is increasingly revealed to the U.S. public. We Americans are now faced with precisely the situation the German people of the 1930s faced. We elected a criminal government to save us from communism and are stuck. This brings up the question of the proper moral response and attitude of the U.S. citizen who did not know this. From Dick's September 1973 public letter to an Australian fanzine. These musings continue in an unabatedly secular vein and reveal, just scant months before 2374, how Dick already describes Watergate in terms of an epical breach, yet interpreted here purely in 20th century political terms. Jonathan Lethem, J.L. End note. He wrote again and again to Charles Wiggins, for instance, especially him, with an enormous intensity. Congressman Wiggins wrote back a long detailed answer to each letter. The spirit even wrote to the Wall Street Journal, a letter which they printed, informing them that Nixon's transcripts were self-serving and full of lies, and time would reveal this, as it certainly did. This spirit, very Elijah-like, but also as Christ spoke of the advocate being, confuted the lies of the world with enormous insight into them. He used legal terms I don't generally use. You wouldn't believe his animosity toward the tyrannies both here and in the USSR. He saw them as twin horns of the same evil entity, one vast worldwide state whose basic nature was clear to him as being one of slavery, a continuation of Rome itself. And he was a foe to that, above all. He saw Caesar once more, and himself pitted against that. What perhaps is involved here is time travel, the ability by someone or several someones, far back in the past, circa 600 BC, to travel forward through to our period by large leaps surfacing in one or more of us. In February, I had major oral surgery and was home recovering, still under the influence of the sodium pentothal, and in severe pain. Tessa phoned the oral surgeon, and he phoned a pharmacy to send out a painkiller. The doorbell rang, and I went, and there stood this girl, with black, black hair and large eyes, very lovely and intense. I stood staring at her, amazed, also confused, thinking I'd never seen such a beautiful girl. And why was she standing there? She handed me the package of medication, and I tried to think what to say to her. I noticed then a fascinating gold necklace around her neck, and I said, "What is that? It certainly is beautiful." Just, you see, to find something to say to hold her there. The girl indicated the major figure in it, which was a fish. "This is a sign used by the early Christians," she said, and then departed. Soon thereafter, the dazzling shower of colored graphics descended over me in the night, and you know the rest. During the first weeks, while the spirit was within me in full force, I saw, among all the other insights I developed, that there are external signals which act on us as disinhibiting stimuli, which cause a vast drop in GABA fluid in the brain, releasing, intentionally, as with the little creatures, major engramming. Evidently, this is what the fish sign did to me. In fact, I read in one article on brain function that when inhibiting GABA fluid drops quite a bit, which is when an external signal causes major disinhibition to take place, the person experiences abstracts, much like the modern painters have reproduced. And this does fit my experience. I felt during those initial days a clear and real sense of being in the hands of programming or engramming from a very early period in my life, probably within the first 4 years of it. I was quite frightened, being unable to grasp what this indicated in terms of what it might cause me to do. However, it swiftly informed me via written material presented in dream after dream of the benign and reassuring quality of this other, which I had encountered deep within me, an other which had been slumbering, inhibited by the GABA fluid until the proper signal released it to assume parity with me. Now we function smoothly in synchronization, but at first I had to yield to it. Rapidly, it handled my problems in ways I never would have thought of, resourceful and wise, and concerned always with the general good, not mine alone, looking always clearly at the future. Love, Phil.